This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most popular reference books about breast cancer has just been updated. My guest is the author, Dr. Susan Love. She's a surgeon and an activist. She directs the UCLA Breast Center, and she co-founded the National Breast Cancer Coalition. When she became a surgeon in 1980, there were almost no women doctors working with breast cancer patients. She was the first female general surgeon at the hospital in Boston where she first practiced. Perhaps her perspective as a woman explains why she has differed from the medical establishment in some of her opinions and recommendations. Dr. Susan Love's breast book was first published in 1990. In the new edition, she questions the importance of breast self-exams.
Breast self-exam is really wishful thinking. We wish that breast self-exam would work in terms of early detection and in terms of catching breast cancer at a different stage, but it really doesn't work very well. And that would be okay, except that it scares women to death, and I think it distracts us from moving forward into something that really does work.
Why doesn't it work?
It doesn't work because the notion of early detection, in fact, isn't entirely right. We've sold it as if every cancer goes from a grain of sand to a BB to a pea to a grape to a lemon to a grapefruit. You know, and if you just do your breast self-exam, you can find it when it's a grain of sand and life will be great. The problem is what you're feeling when you feel a cancer are not the cancer cells. It's the reaction they incite around them. And until it's a certain size, you're not going to feel that. So in some people, the cancer shows up as a grape, and it never was a grain of sand or a pea. And in some people, it shows up as a grapefruit. And this notion that if you just examined yourself, you would find it at a smaller size just isn't true. It just wasn't a smaller size. Some people are lucky, and they do have lumps that are found very early, but not in general.
Well, how are most lumps discovered?
Well, most women do find their own lumps, but they don't find them doing breast self-exam. They find them in the shower, they're rolling over in bed, their lover finds it. It's not because they stood in front of the mirror and did a whole song and dance, because most women, in fact, don't do it. They're too scared. It's too scary, and it really sort of, I think it alienates women from their bodies. Instead of thinking of your breast as a nice, friendly part of you, it becomes the enemy, and your job is to find the hidden landmine that's, you know, going to do you in.
But you don't think you even stand a big chance of discovering a lump sooner with a breast self-exam than you would if you were just waiting for discovering it haphazardly in the shower or while making out?
Maybe a little bit, but not that much. I think that, you know, breast self-exam was really invented back in a time when women didn't touch themselves down there, and down there was below the chin, you know. The notion is to touch your body, and I think nowadays many more women, you know, women are more aware of it, and they do that. But they're too scared to, they feel like they have to do this whole thing and really catalog every grain of sand and, you know, really go on a search and destroy mission. And I think that really isn't necessary.
Dr. Susan Love is my guest. Do you think I'm going to get a lot of phone calls after this broadcast from gynecologists saying that what you have just said is irresponsible?
No, I don't. But I think that there are some women who found their cancers doing breast self-exam are the ones who get upset and feel like if they found theirs that way, then we shouldn't be disregarding it. And the problem is not so much, I mean, I don't think it's evil for people to do breast self-exam. I just think we shouldn't be putting so much money and effort into it. We should be putting the money into really finding a really good way of early detection, maybe a blood test or something like that.
Women who have, you know, what is often described as lumpy breasts are often told they have fibrocystic disease.
Right.
Which you say is not really a disease.
It's not a disease at all. It's really a garbage term that we use to cover anything going on in the breast that isn't cancer. So lumps, pain, swelling, discharge, anything that's going on where the physician or the healthcare provider doesn't think it's cancer, they'll say, "Don't worry, dear, it's fibrocystic disease." And this makes the doctor or the provider feel better because they have something to write in the insurance form. And it makes the patient feel worse because now she has a disease. It's actually no more a disease than menstrual cramps are a disease or hot flashes are a disease. It's part of the normal response of the breast to hormonal cycling. And you don't have to do anything about it. What happens is once you label it a disease, then the patient wants a treatment. And we don't have any treatment, really. And so then the doctor says something like, "Stop drinking coffee," which in fact has been shown not to have any difference, make any difference in benign breast problems. But they hope maybe it'll have a placebo effect. Maybe the patient will feel better anyway. And so you get on this path by calling it a disease that's really erroneous.
Well, haven't a lot of women been told by their doctors that if they have fibrocystic disease, they're more likely to develop breast cancer in the future?
Well, that was thought. And in fact, my first paper in this field, which I hate to say is now almost 20 years ago, was about that and was writing how fibrocystic disease, quote unquote, does not increase your risk of cancer at all. And I didn't get any critiques from anybody. I mean, the gynecologist didn't call me on the phone and yell and scream because everybody agreed. They said, oh, yeah, we know that. So it's really a myth that somehow has gotten out there and gets propagated that if you have lumpy breasts, you're more likely to get cancer, and that therefore if you treat lumpy breasts, you can prevent cancer, neither of which is true.
What's the latest on the breast cancer gene?
The breast cancer gene, well, one of them, because it's probably going to be more than one, was identified last fall. And the gene that was identified is for breast and ovarian cancer. So it's families where the grandmother had ovarian and the mother had breast and two aunts had ovarian and, you know, your sister had breast cancer. It's that kind of a family. And we're at least have I cloned the gene for that. We don't yet have a blood test for it, so we can't test for it yet. It's going to be more than one gene. All cancer is genetic. It's all genes that get screwed up. Sometimes you inherit the screwed-up gene, and sometimes you acquire the screwed-up gene by exposure to carcinogens or something in the environment or pesticides or whatever. So this gene is one that's inherited. But in most cases of breast cancer, the genes aren't inherited. Only 5% of breast cancer is hereditary, is really inherited. So the gene will be important, the blood test will be important, but only for a very limited number of women. And, you know, the big worry, too, is at least if healthcare stays the way it is, if you test positive for this gene, you'll never get health insurance again in this country.
Hmm. As a doctor, what are you hoping that the gene will eventually tell us and help us prevent or help us do?
Well, it's the first step to figuring out what are the genetic steps that cause breast cancer? What are the screwed-up genes that are going to lead to breast cancer? And if we can figure out what those are, then we have the potential for fixing them, either fixing the broken gene or replacing whatever it is that the broken gene is supposed to do. Let's say it's supposed to make a certain protein. Then we could give you that protein. So by figuring out the really basis of breast cancer, what the genes are, will really open the doors for us to be able to figure out much more subtle ways of treating it or preventing it.
Dr. Susan Love is my guest, and there's a new edition of her book, Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book. What do you recommend to your patients about how often they should get mammograms?
Well, I think that there's no controversy, and everyone agrees that mammography in women over 50 works great. And so every woman over 50 should be getting regular mammograms every 2 years or every year. Below 50 is much more tricky because with all the studies that have been done, we still haven't been able to show a difference in mortality of breast cancer in women who get mammograms under 50. And so right now, the American Cancer Society is saying, yes, we should still do it under 50, and the National Cancer Institute is saying, no, maybe we shouldn't. I think that women at 40 should get one mammogram and see what their breasts look like. One of the problems with mammography in younger women is that the breast tissue is dense and that cancer doesn't show up so well against dense breast tissue. And so as you get older, and particularly once you go through menopause, the dense breast tissue starts to fade away, it gets replaced by fat, and cancer shows up great against fat. So one of the reasons mammography works better over 50 is because the breast tissue is less dense. Some young women have fatty breasts, even though they're under 50. And so you can do a mammogram at 40, see what your breasts look like, see whether it's going to be worth it for you, weigh the risks and benefits in your case if you have a family history or other risk factors, and make your own decision about whether it's worth it for you in that earlier decade. I wouldn't start before 40.
What about the risk from radiation?
Well, radiation definitely causes cancer. But it's interesting because it's low-dose radiation, and it's particularly depends when you get it, at least for breast cancer. So it seems like radiation in the, quote, immature breast, around puberty, even in infancy or childhood, will increase the risk more than radiation later. So girls who had scoliosis and had x-rays of their back once a week to see whether it was straight or not when they were in puberty, they have more breast cancer. At one point, we were treating acne of the chest with radiation back in the 50s. They have more breast cancer. People who had tuberculosis, again, as teenagers, and they kept checking on their lungs with fluoroscopy, they have more breast cancer. So there's something about radiation in the young, immature breast tissue, which is, in fact, quite dangerous. And then later on, it's less dangerous. Once the tissue is more, quote, mature, it's less sensitive.
I keep reading different things about when lumpectomy and when mastectomy are called for, and I wonder what your latest thinking on that is, when you recommend one over the other.
Well, I think that most of the time, lumpectomy and radiation is a procedure of choice. And the only time, in fact, when we do a mastectomy is when the lump is so big and the breast is so small that you can't do a lumpectomy. So it's really size of the tumor and size of the breast. We have this erroneous notion that if you cut the breast off, cancer won't come back again. And in fact, the recurrence rate after mastectomy in the scar is about 8 to 10%. And the recurrence rate in the breast after lumpectomy and radiation is about 8 to 10%. So it's exactly the same. And mastectomy doesn't give you any advantage as far as having the cancer come back. So in some ways, lumpectomy and radiation is the most aggressive because you can radiate a bigger area than I as a surgeon can cut out. So lumpectomy and radiation is probably the first choice. I think it's the first choice anyway. And only when I can't do it because the lump is too big do we do a mastectomy.
Some women are so afraid that they're at a high risk for breast cancer that they have preventive mastectomies to prevent breast cancer. You write that you've done four of them during your whole career. These women must have worked really hard to persuade you to do it.
Took them a year or so of nagging, yeah. Yeah, the problem with it is that we don't get all the breast tissue when we do a mastectomy. It's not a different color. It doesn't look different. In fact, I hate to say it all looks like chicken fat in there. We think we're very sexy, but we're not that different than chickens. And we get some of the breast tissue, but not all of it. You know, the ducts themselves, milk ducts, go up as high as the collarbone and down to the ribs. If you just, anybody who's breastfed and thinks about what happened when their milk came in and how big their breast suddenly became and how extensively it swelled up, you realize how much breast tissue is really there compared to what we see otherwise. And so we never get it all out. And removing 95% of the tissue does not remove 95% of the risk. It may remove some of the risk. We don't know. Nobody's really studied it. In animals, it doesn't remove any of the risk. I mean, they've actually done studies on rats who have 12 breasts, and they remove 3 or 6 or 9 or 12 of their breasts, and then they give them a carcinogen. They get the same number of cancers as if no matter how much breast tissue you've removed. So the answer is probably not trying to remove the breast tissue. It's figuring out some way of prevention that is systemic, that will get to all the tissue, and that really will prevent the disease.
Dr. Susan Love is my guest, and there's a new edition of her book, Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Susan Love, there's a new edition of her breast book that's just been published. There's a relatively new treatment for breast cancer that uses very high doses of chemotherapy and removes either bone marrow or blood cells. I'd like you to explain the basic premise of that procedure.
Well, we've been using chemotherapy. I should back up a minute and say one of the problems in breast cancer and one of the things we've realized in the last decade is that it's been there a long time and that cancer cells get out into the rest of the body well before we get on the scene. And so that's why mastectomy doesn't work or lumpectomy and radiation, because those cells are already in other more important organs, lungs, liver, bones. And that's what really kills people from breast cancer. So we started using chemotherapy. Drugs get into the bloodstream, circulate around, find those cells, blast the hell out of them. The problem is even that doesn't work that well. And there were still a lot of women who would get chemotherapy and would still die of breast cancer. So people said, aha, maybe it's because we're not giving enough chemotherapy. Now, the limiting factor was, how much the bone marrow, which makes your red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets, could tolerate, because chemotherapy is indiscriminate. It interferes with any dividing cells, not just cancer. So they said, what we'll do is we'll take the bone marrow out, we'll stick it in the freezer, we'll blast the hell out of you with very high doses of chemo, and then we'll get your bone marrow out of the freezer and give it back to you. So it's a different kind of bone marrow transplant than is used for some of the bone marrow cancers, where you get somebody else's bone marrow. This is just a way of protecting your bone marrow so you can have super high doses of chemo. And now we've got it refined so that you don't even have to do the bone marrow. You can actually take some of the bone marrow cells out of the bloodstream and do it. But the problem is we have, as of yet, not proven that more chemotherapy is better, that the studies are going on right now, and it may or may not be that the problem was how much dose we gave. It may be that it has to do with the fact that we don't have the right drugs, or that chemotherapy itself is maybe not the right answer. We know that the radical mastectomy didn't work any better than lumpectomy and radiation. And so it's not necessarily true that just because it's higher doses, it's going to work better.
While you're going through the bone marrow transplant, I think it's just really horrible. You basically lose your immune system for weeks.
That's right.
And you become prone to many different kinds of severe opportunistic infections. What advice do you give women about whether the payoffs are worth the risk?
Well, I think this is something every woman has to weigh for herself. And it depends very much on where her head is, whether she is a risk taker or not, whether she wants to gamble on something which may have a big payoff and may not. And I think that it's important that women get realistic information about it. I think sometimes in our enthusiasm to try new things as physicians, we oversell things. We say, well, you know, your risk of dying is 50% or 60% from this cancer, and chemotherapy will improve that a bit, but maybe if you do this transplant, you'll be even better. And it's very hard for someone to turn that down. But I think women need to realize that this is still experimental, that the data is really not out yet on how effective this is. And that there's always a risk. You know, there's no free lunch. And so you're always gambling one thing for another.
You've described the standard therapy for breast cancer as slash, poison, and burn.
That's right.
Very unpleasant. And yet, that's all you have. Those are the only tools you have to work with right now.
That's right. And that's what I do. I mean, I once got a complaint after I had said that in a medical journal, saying, we in the trenches are working very hard, and how dare you call it slash, burn, and poison. I said, listen, I'm in the trenches. I operate on breast cancer. I do all of this stuff. It's just that it's a very crude way to deal with disease. And if we really understood breast cancer, we would not be dealing with it this crudely. And my hope is that as we start to understand the molecular biology, we'll get to much more subtle treatments that will work a lot better.
Give me an idea of what your dream is of a treatment that might happen in your lifetime.
Well, I think, first of all, we'll figure out how to prevent breast cancer in my lifetime. Whether it's fixing the gene, whether it's replacing the abnormal protein, whether it's identifying what the carcinogen is so that we can eliminate it, I'm sure that we'll have a way of preventing it, and then we won't have to deal with any of this stuff. But in terms of treatment, it's actually, there are a lot of steps, you know, for breast cancer or any cancer to spread. First, it has to grow inside the milk duct. Then it has to develop the ability to get out of the milk duct. Then it has to sort of make new blood vessels grow in to feed it. Then it has to be able to crawl over to the new blood vessel and break into the blood vessel and survive in the bloodstream with all the immune system trying to get it. And then it has to be able to get out in another organ and make more new blood vessels grow in. All of these steps can be interfered with. Right now, there are trials going on to see with anti-angiogenesis drugs, drugs that block the growth of new blood vessels. If you do that, then the cancer can't grow. If you block the ability of the cancer to survive in the bloodstream, then it can't survive. Or even better, I mean, this is one of my big fantasies. There are cases of patients who have had breast cancer, have been fully treated, and do fine for 10 years, 15 years, and then the cancer comes back again. What were those cells doing for 10 or 15 years? They were asleep. What put them to sleep? If they can be asleep for 15 years, why not can't they be asleep for 30 years or 40 years? So if we could figure out how to do that, we wouldn't have to kill them. We wouldn't have to slash, burn, and poison. We'd just put them all to sleep.
Do you have any hypotheses about the causes of breast cancer?
Well, as I said earlier, all cancer is genetic. It's all genes that are screwed up. And I think that the question is, what screws them up? Right now, we're looking at a lot of things in the environment. Pesticides is one hot topic right now, and we know that pesticides, a lot of them are metabolized like estrogen, like DDT is metabolized as estrogen. And so people are wondering whether that relates to breast cancer. Diet is another one, not just fat in the diet, which is sort of being questioned, but things like soy protein and plant estrogens that may be protective that we don't have as much in our diet right now. We know that exercise more than three times a week actually decreases breast cancer by about 40%, and that's also hormonal. And I can't help but think that right now, when we use so many hormones in women through the pill, through fertility drugs, through postmenopausal hormones, that adding all this hormones to our bodies is probably not good as far as breast cancer is concerned.
Dr. Susan Love, she has a new edition of her book, which is called Dr. Susan Love's Breast Book. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.